Mr. James, Reel 37. The black market seemed to be kind of all pervasive.
Right. We were in this area, the whole of 6th Battalion IRPG was spread out from one village called Pialisi to Chervinar, about 3 or 4 miles north. And all along this route were the various companies of the IRTD. The Scots, the Jocks, were down where I was in Paris, A, B, C, D company there. Headquarters, of course, was in a house in the village, the Syndico house. Syndico is the mayor. And it was the best house in the village, and of course, that was the Colonel Granddad. For his battalion quarters in his own office and even his living quarters, together with his second in command, Major Gornall, and the training officer. His name escapes me now. He was a very military looking man, a major, who was on the big in the stock exchange in London before the war. But he had a deep tan, and I remember particularly that. One night, we mounted the guard, and he came out rushing. His flat had just been pitched by two or three blokes, and one of them, he said, had a dirty RB jacket with black buttons. Now he said, "I want you." He said to me, "I want you." He says to you're on the village picket tonight. He said, "Picket the village where all the." Permanent staff and also the chaps waiting to go up the line who were temporarily for a few days in the IRPD used to go up to the village of Pialisi where there were two or three shady places where they sold vermouth. And they were all packed every night. Anyway, we went up to reach Kelly Pickhells for protection. And there was a picket of six men nominated every night and an NCO. And they all had pickhands, they were allowed to use them as well if they had to. And the regimental military police also had these pickhands, and they were also patrolling the village. Anyway, we were asked to watch out for this chap with a dirty army jacket and black buttons. We went in and out, and I made it my duty to accompany the picket this particular night because of this chap's son. And we went into this crowded bar, and straight away I saw him. And I went up to him and I said, "I'm going to the 64," and he told me, "Run," so I grabbed him. And I said, "Now," I said, "Who are you?" I said, you're not even benefited, are you?" But what he was doing, he was getting in with the crowd and having his food. Now, one had to be very, very alert, you know, that we didn't have deserters coming in for food into the canteens and into the, so on. He was caught. So I said, "You've got nothing to identify yourself?" He said, "I've got a copy of my syphilis treatment card." And he's very arrogant and truculent. And I said, "Right, well," I said, "I'm taking you now down to regimental quarters." I said, "There's a major down there waiting to identify you." And I said, "You're under arrest." So I took him outside, and of course everybody in the sort of cafe was watching this thing. And he was really one I was interested in. And so the whole picket, marched him down. He was in the middle of three men ahead and three men behind, and I was walking to the side. And all of these pickets, I said, "Oh, Lucy gave me." He said, "You'd be no bloody good without that, you know." So I said, "Well, we see when we get down there." So anyway, we marched him down and we arranged for this major. He said, that's a chap. And we searched him and we had one or two artifacts on him. And so he was a deserter in the bag. That was one instance.
What was RB? What was the RB jacket? What does that stand for?
Well, Rifle Brigade. He was an ex-Rifle Brigade man. And he was on the run, and he'd been on the run for ages, living with the Italians. But the crafty devil came up and knew where the IRTD companies were. And apparently, of course, he had one or two chaps as well, already sort of known to him, who were G chap at the German reinforcements, where have you got the knife? And they fed them, and he got into his club.
Well, were there a lot of deserters then, in the area?
Quite a lot. It was very rife. And they were the cause of crime in the military establishments, usually, because they would get in league with the Italian thieves, and they'd become one of them. And it was quite rife, actually. And so you should live with them as well, you see, and so they become part of the Italian gang.
So what kind of security checks would you have? I mean, how would the camp be organised in terms of its...
Well, we were very, very security-minded. And I was going to say, what they did, they eventually, the road passed the lines, and we looked up, and there were all the grapevines and the sloping tents going up, you know, into the vast sort of vineyards. So what we did, we made wattle hedges, and we got some of the village to supply us with this stuff. And so we really fenced off from the road the whole of the camp and camp of the areas eventually, and had a bloke standing at the gate at the entrance to each company. Now, in addition to the company areas, there was an enormous sort of field leading down to the marquee where they had grub. And there we fenced off a big entrance there. I put up this sign, it is forbidden to enter without authority to the Italians. But poverty was so rife in this village. Kids had no clothes and they had no food. And what they used to do, these children, when you're back to the town, they'd get in somehow to the school bins. And oh, poor kids, they had maybe a great big jam tin, you know, which held about one time about 4 pounds of jam. And they'd have this jam tin with a bit of swill in it, and that would be their swill food carrying vessel. And they'd go and put their hands in the swill and get out these uneaten cold potatoes and also. And this is how they lived, and carted this swill away. There were families to eat as well. It was awful, really. We felt sorry for the kids. We'd be caught to give the backhander and pretend that we were angry. We couldn't let the poor kids. We sort of, you know, we showed them that we didn't want them in there. We are, go away, you see. And non return, though, don't come back, you know. But you don't get away with this bloody swill. This is the only thing they had to eat. And the women in the village did all the free, all the work. We were all peasants. And they worked in the fields. The women worked, and the men were so thin and emaciated due to excessive sex that they had no strength at all. And we soldiers used to sort of say to them, because they used to walk behind the women would pick up a half of a cask of water from the pump and put it on her head. Now, water is very heavy. A gallon of water weighs 10 pounds, I think. But you imagine a half of the barrel on this woman's head and water. She had muscles. And she was carrying this thing of water, and her hands would be walking behind you. And we say, "You lazy bastard, why did you carry it for her? You lazy bugger. Come on, get it on your head." But he didn't respect. And you know, the soldiers were annoyed to see these women being exploited by the men. And then I remember particularly that they were also poverty stricken, and they were awful. And they lived, they were I contadini, they were the peasants who were so poor that they had nothing at all and hardly anything in the furnishings of the house. So very, very inclined as well, you know, to sort of grade officers' lines for all sorts of stuff they could pinch. And the officers' lines were at the side of the main road, the other side down in a dip. Very, very vulnerable. No guards ever posted the officers' lines. I mean, we were warned that all the officers had to come in and, you know, zip up your tent, or tie up your tent, and look after yourself. Don't leave any hanging about because it'll go. And I was, whenever I passed it, I was very vigilant. And as I said, my last thing, I did catch some of the British soldiers stealing officers' equipment. But it was very, very rife, and you had to be very security conscious in every way.
Did you have to have the same problem with your own troops in the terms of which they would be? Obviously, there was a black market.
Especially if they thought they could get away with it. I mean, every soldier had they came from, shall we say, from England or from ex-hospital to us for a few days, and they were kept busy by so-called training in various areas with us. But we had to supply them with a bed, a paddocks and blankets and whatnot. And we had to be very, very careful that those blankets were there on the day they were going out, so we'd have an inspection in the morning to make sure that there was nothing missing. And of course, now they were. Now, what they'd done is some of them had flung the blankets, you see, to the natives. They'd sell everything at a value. And anything they could pitch as well on sale at a value.
What would the punishment be for a man that was discovered?
Well, they would, I mean, we didn't have it long enough to give them the CV, so they would hit through the pocket. And, you know, stop so many days' pay. And all the sort of thing. And 2x2 followed them to their units.
What's
2x2? 2x2 was a charge sheet. Yeah. And so the only method was to spin them financially.
Do you think there was any collusion with the black market from the actual staff of the camp, like the QMs, quartermasters, and so on?
The staff of the camp, of course, were suspect. And you knew who they were, and you watched them very, very carefully. And you got rid of them as well, if you could, at the earliest opportunity.
Okay. Have you got any memories of that happening, any specific instances?
I had memories of one particular bloke, he was he was a sergeant, and he didn't like me at all. And by now we know the sergeant's mess down there as well. Well, I was the most inoffensive child, I didn't want to sort of fight anybody. But one Sunday, he decided to, he had a weakness, and he obviously told, I came in late because I was nearly the last one to have my food, and I was sitting alone in the mess. And, the bar was at the far end of the mess. It was a sort of a mess down there with the drinking part in the evening, and the food part was up here. But anyway, she thought that he would entertain his many friends down there and come down and make a distance to himself and start a sort of sit beside me, and when I was eating, he sort of put his elbow up, and eventually I said, "Now look," I said, "I know you're a bit pissed." I said, "Go on, back off." I said, "I don't want you to lose your stripes." And with that, he said, "I'll come outside." He said, "Is your badge of rank a lollipop, or is it?" I said, "No." I said, "Come on. Go away." So I got him by the collar and I took him to the door to put him out of the mess, and he punched me in the face very, very hard before I closed the door. Well, I waited a while until I got over it, and then when I recovered, I opened the door. Well, there was a thunderous rush across the room by about 500 pairs of boots before to see the action. And they were just in time, and I walked up to him and I've got quite a good right hand, and they say, so I've never sort of spoken about it, but I got another punch. And I caught him on the forehead, and he went reeling back about 35 yards before he went down. And I heard the gasp. This girl didn't know that I was like, I was so docile. I looked as if Mother wouldn't have nothing in my mouth, but I was there. So they all rushed forward to him, and I knew that he didn't want to go on. I walked back in the mess, and they told him to pack him off, disappear. But I sought him out, and I put him on a charge, and he was down, he was busted. Devoted to corporal, and he was posted away. That was that instance.
And you think he was involved with the black market as well?
I thought that he was a real rotter, actually. Yeah, a real rotter.
Did you What was your
general? He worked in different companies as well, and he was on the training staff of the they had a 6th Battalion IRTV training staff of sergeants who reported to the training officer at the Battalion quarters daily for instructions, and he was one of those, and he was a good.
Generally, what was the relationship between the camp and the civilians in terms of?
That's a good question, because one of the sergeants in the camp, the pioneer sergeant, was actually courting what was regarded as the best looking woman in the village. His name was Sergeant Skinner. And he used to, apparently, virtually, well, he was never seen with his woman, but he was a good worker, and he was a marvellous side writer as well. Oh, incidentally, I've got an example of his work. I've got a smash for you. Go in the next room, or you can't.
We'll look at that later.
I've got my little table name plate, which he did for me. CSMJ, CSMWJ, the Delmar Secretary, a work of art. Now, his relationship was allowed because he was such a handy man, and he'd bring her into the next meetings as well, and that was allowed. So there were one or two sergeants as well who had cultivated friendships like that.
So there were kind of liaisons.
Yes, but they were, those women who were friendly with the troops, were outcasts, because these village people, and they incidentally within the mountains as well, were so narrow-minded that I would imagine that when we moved out, those women would be, they'd be pilloried. The men were jealous, the women and the people in the village were so narrow-minded that it was unbelievable. None of their young girls were allowed to sort of even talk or look at the troops, and the troops were told as well to leave the villages alone. And they were very, very narrow-minded, very funny mentality they had, very jealous, country for, they knew, you see, that if a girl in the village got married, for example, it was a very, very big occasion on the wedding night. They would apparently, I don't know, but I heard that they would examine the sheets after she has lost her virginity. If she had lost her virginity before, her life was finished.
Were there any things that the British troops were short of that they would trade that would feed the black market?
I dare say that there were many things that they could sort of.
The one that springs to mind is obviously women's company, that there would be like a prostitution. Yeah. Was that
their main need was food, believe it or not. Their main need was food. And I'm quite certain that some of the drug went to them.
And do you think that would be in exchange for kind of sexual favours and things?
Absolutely, absolutely. And also, of course, as well, from somewhere, maybe from neighbours, God knows from where, there would be lingering about a quarter of a mile or so from the camp, prostitutes hiding in from the authorities, hiding from anybody who went to go from the police. And the Carabinieri, the Italian police, were very well aware of it, but they were prostitutes. And they were there to offer themselves for cioccolato, usually, or anything like that, especially from the soldiers. A soldier could go with a prostitute for a bar of chocolate. And they were there. But of course, in order to prevent venereal disease and all that sort of thing, if we were well aware of it, we'd go and we'd arrest them and hand them over to the Carabinieri. And we did that quite frequently, as a matter of fact.
And you don't think these were local women, though, were they?
But local women, they were from all sorts of places out, but they knew that this was the Mecca for them, because they knew that this was the reinforcement camp. The lads were going up the line, and they knew that they could have, you know, as many, well, maybe not as chocolate, but mainly in food, as I say.
Did you notice any kind of organized crime, in the sense, I mean, were there Italians that you suspected of being like,
well, there's organized crime as well, because
people have talked to the mafia.
The Italian I ladri, we used to call them, the thieves. I ladri, a lado is a thief, and I ladri are the thieves. And that does everybody's talk about I ladri. You could turn your back, you couldn't leave anything, and it would go. If a vehicle was left unattended for a very short time, the four wheels and tires would go, and you'd find a vehicle on bricks. It's amazing. They were very adept, and God knows how they sort of appeared and disappeared, I don't know. But trucks were found, you know, minus wheels, and things like that. And the contents of the truck as well would go. Anything would go. It was, there was a black market, there was no petrol, there was no tires, no vehicle parts, and of course the Italian Camorra, which is the Neapolitan mafia, were very active indeed.
So, in general terms, how would you describe the Italian society? How would you sum it up at this time?
The Italian society, they were very, very poor. This was the part of Italy that Mussolini never assisted. It was so far south, Naples, that Mussolini, the rich were up north, and the prosperous ones were up in the northern cities. But down in the south, Naples was a filthy city and a poverty-stricken city. It was very poor. And the villages all around, you know, they were living off what they could grow, and they kept maiale, pigs, you know, but they didn't have food to feed them. And they lived on burning charcoal. They used to sort of go up every morning. It was very, very, one of the memories was in the middle of the night. We soldiers in our bedroom, the rally was about 6 o'clock, but about 4 o'clock we would hear the most wonderful singing. And the young girls in the village would have assembled. And they'd be climbing this steep, steep mountain that overlooked our camp. It was very, very high. It rose all day. Yeah, it was, you know, it was 45 degrees, and going up and up and up. And they burned charcoal up there all day, and seemed to be smoke. But when they were up the mountain to the where they could get there, you know, and stuff to burn their charcoal up there, they would chant the most wonderful, harmonious Neapolitan sort of songs. Oh, and you could listen to it. It was wonderful. If it could have been recorded, you know, it was. Well, they were all gifted with singing voices and harmony. You know, going up the mountain, and then you get the contralto, you get the soprano cutting up and going right up to the door, fantastic music. Every morning, singing at the market to burn the charcoal. What are the memories?
Were any places out of bounds to the British troops? Were there any places?
Oh, yes. There were certain places out of bounds. I mean, in the village, we inspected the little catalysts, and we allowed them to trade. Where we thought there was something suspect, actually, like making drinks from wood alcohol and human urine, and there was one like that. And troops were temporarily blinded for 2 or 3 days. But they were affected. And they were, it was very serious. And we found out where they were drinking, and we closed them down. But generally speaking, the only place I had to go was after the Institute of Vino, the Vermouth.
So when you say human urine, what do you mean by that? In
when
the
I
wine?
Say what?
When you say that they would make liquor out of like human urine, how would that work? They would.
Well, it came back to us that some of this hooch that they've been drinking was analyzed, and it was wood alcohol, human urine with a dash of vino or vodka, and they were selling this to the troops, and because it was a very market, the troops were too pleased to go up there. There was one particular girl called Dorina, and she would share all the charms. And she was an outcast in the village, but my God, all the troops went to her place because she was an idol, And she would serve until, everybody was should be back in camp at about 10:30. But she would be trying to serve vino after that, and she had in her little sort of front room, which is she had an olive oil saucer with a bit of strip in it. And this was the night, and she'd have 3 or 4 of these olive oil candles to give sunlight in the place. And there was a glow there. It was dark, and you had the olive oil candles. And in the winter as well, they had this enormous round metal thing in the room, the windows, where they burnt the charcoal that they made up in the mountains, and that the charcoal supplied the heat to the village in the winter.
So, what were you inspecting when you were inspecting this bar, these little bars? You were inspecting that.
I can speak Italian as well. I'm a new Dorina, and I can speak Italian, engage in a conversation, and I used to say. Only the best. Vermut, only the best. Si, my migliore, none better than mine, So I said, right, well, don't sell any rubbish, and if you've got any problems, come and tea us. And if you treat the soldiers well, you can sort of carry on. And she was one of the popular ones, and we allowed her. She was the one basically we recommended. Troops to use, as a matter of fact, and she also had the biggest room in the village. The troops had to have some recreation. But later on, we built in the each company, we built a shed, or we did it at the RE's camp, and built a canteen for each company, and to give them. If they didn't want to go out to drink the local rubbish, we had naffy goods from Naples and whatnot, and a place where they could sort of sit and drink beer. But the Italian beer was awful. But we had no glasses, and then I had an idea from years and years previously. I decided, I told the company commander that I had a good idea for making glasses for the troops. So he said, how do you make glasses? Well, I said, all these bottles can be used. And you get me 1/2 pint of oil, engine oil, and a steel rod, something to heat it red hot with, and I can make glasses. So we'll do it there. We filled the empty bottle up to the required depth, say 1/2 pint of glass, and inserted a red hot steel rod down in the oil, which started to heat up, and the intense heat rose to the top of the oil, to the rim, and click, cracked the bottle, and you just lifted the top off, and you had the oil was there at the level, and you poured that into a receptacle, and you made another glass with the oil. And I made sufficient glasses, first of all, for the whole company. It caught on. The other company commanders saw the idea, and they did the